This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. We really appreciate you joining us on Trumpet Hour today, and our panel of trumpet writers are all on deck, and they're anxious to tell you all about the biggest stories of the week. Here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Great to be here.
And joining us via Skype from our office in the UK, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And also in the UK, we have Kieran Underwood.
Thanks for having me.
And via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
Well, anyone who has been listening to the Trumpet Hour for very long, or who has followed our magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet, or listened to our program, Watch Jerusalem, knows that we give more scrutiny and attention to events happening in Jerusalem, Israel, than to what's happening in any other city of the world. Bible prophecy provides an abundant amount of details, just explaining what will occur in Jerusalem in the end time, so we have quite a lot to watch for there. And over the last week or so, the situation has become remarkably tense, and it could be poised to quickly explode into something far more serious. To tell us about this, we'll go to the host of the Watch Jerusalem program and our man in the Middle East, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, so this is a story that obviously we've talked about at length. Even Stephen Fleury on his program this week has talked about what's going on in Jerusalem. And it kind of really came to a head today, although it looks like it's probably going to continue into next week. And this, the impasse, what we're seeing in Jerusalem right now is quite a lot of rioting, people assembling to try and get onto the Temple Mount to pray. But Israel, because of the terrorist attack we talked about last week, Israel has put up metal detectors at the entrance points to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. So if any Muslim wants to come and pray at the Temple Mount, they are still able to do that if they so desire, but they have to pass through what they are calling metal gates, which are just basically a metal detector. And so far, they are refusing to do that, the broad majority of them, instead choosing to pray for the five prayers that they have each day outside of the Temple Mount. Around some of the gates to the old city itself, and even a lot of leaders, Palestinian leaders, Muslim leaders, have come out and said, don't go through the metal detectors, try and force Israel, force their hand to try and remove these. And today, obviously, Friday is more important. Friday morning prayers and Friday prayers are very important to the Muslims, so there was a greater abundance of people in Jerusalem coming to protest and attempt, or at least to pray outside the Temple Mount itself. And that led to some pretty violent clashes today. Some of them are still going on right now. But I think there's about 160 people were injured. Rubber bullets were fired. Different crowds were kind of dispersed through stun grenades, tear gas, that type of thing, to try and stop the Palestinians from rioting or attacking police.
So do you see this this metal detector requirement remaining in place, or do you think that Israel will be forced to back down?
Well, it really depends. I mean, even today, what happened was the police were given the directive that if they so chose at a certain point, depending on who the person was, they could actually say, don't worry about going through the metal detector. Hey, we will. And that was even announced to people at the metal detectors. We will allow you through. Just let us check your bags and things like that. But then they said, well, we're not going in until those metal detectors are taken. Metal detectors are taken down. So I can't see Israel taking them down just yet, because what is Israel meant to do? Remember that the attack on Friday came about because armed men took machine guns onto the Temple Mount. And if you enter the Temple Mount as a Muslim up until last Friday, you don't have to go through a metal detector. You're not even checked. You can just walk in there with whatever bag that you want, which seems crazy. If you live in Israel, you go through a metal detector to go into the mall you're going to, any sports stadium. If you're a Jew or a tourist to get on the Temple Mount, you have to go through a metal detector. To get into the Western Wall Plaza, you have to go through a metal detector. Everywhere in Israel, you have to go through a metal detector, apart from being a Muslim going onto the Temple Mount. So remember that they used the Temple Mount to stash the weaponry and then come out and attack the guards from the Temple Mount. And Israel is trying to prevent that. How can they prevent that? Well, the simplest solution they see is a metal detector at the entrance.
What has the U.S.'s view on this been? I've seen some indications that America is possibly urging Israel to back down on the metal detectors and just to search individuals who arouse suspicion. Does that look like your read on it?
Well, that has been even the, some of the Shin Bet, like the Israel CIA, I guess that's been their admonition. Some from the Israeli army have said that, hey, let's just get rid of the metal detectors and check people. But that does become difficult when you've got masses of people coming through, thousands of people coming through for Friday morning prayers. I mean, that'll be difficult to put that many people through a metal detector as well. So I don't know if it is the ultimate solution, but Israel cannot allow the Temple Mount, again, right in the middle of Jerusalem, just across the wall from the Wailing Wall, they cannot allow that to become a breeding ground or a depot for weapons or an area in which attacks are led. So the metal detectors seem like they are the most feasible and easiest solution to this crisis. But again, it's being used by the Arab Muslim community, not just in Israel, but around the Arab world, in the Muslim world. It's being used as an argument that Israel is trying to take over the Temple Mount. They're trying to limit access to Muslims or stop Muslims from getting access to the Temple Mount, trying to change the status quo on the Temple Mount, whereby Arabs are able to worship there. When Israel, if you look at it honestly, doesn't want to change it at all. They wouldn't, Benjamin Netanyahu wouldn't be so bold as to change the status quo on the Temple Mount, especially not now. They're just trying to find a solution to stop people shooting them from the Temple Mount.
Right. When you walk through the streets of Jerusalem, are you able to notice a change that's come about in the last week since those attacks? Is the situation on the ground different?
Well, Jerusalem itself is a small city, and yet you can walk a mile and you're in a different world in some instances. Hmm. And I visited the Lion's Gate, where the attackers were shot, where the police were shot by the attackers on Wednesday with a media group. And I witnessed people, about 200 people praying outside that gate. Looked like it was kind of peaceful, but then they started chanting and getting louder and louder and louder, to the point that somebody provoked one of the Israeli police, and he asked him for his passport or his just to show who he was. He didn't want to give it to him. And then the police arrested him because they didn't show that. And then there was a full blown riot and stun grenades came out. Tear gas didn't come out, but that a lot of that happened today. Every day, five times a day, Muslims have prayers in and around Jerusalem and in these areas of East Jerusalem, around the Temple Mount. Every day there's a flare up. And today was the worst. And Israel's not, looks like they're not taking down these metal detectors. And so it's only going to get worse, it seems.
Could you talk briefly just about how these increasing tensions will in Jerusalem will kind of be a trigger for the fulfillment of some very dramatic Bible prophecies?
Yeah, the reason we're watching this so closely and we care about the area of the Temple Mount so closely is because for a long time, the editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, of the Trumpet magazine has talked about this area being a trigger for end-time events, basically. One of the first signs that we have that things are heading towards the fulfillment of end-time biblical prophecies is the Temple Mount being taken back from Jewish hands over to the Arabs, to a point that they don't allow Jews on there, or the Jews aren't able to show their sovereignty over that site. It's already kind of moving in that direction. But there is, again, a dramatic prophecy found in the book of Zechariah that talks about half of Jerusalem falling. and that leading to other events leading to Jesus Christ's return. It's the first domino, this half of Jerusalem falling. And this impasse, or an impasse over the Temple Mount, is kind of the precursor to that prophecy being fulfilled. And that's why we watch it so closely.
Wow. So this is a really important story for us to keep a close eye on. We appreciate you bringing us up to speed on that, Brent. If you closely follow the news in Europe, you will have noticed an apparent cooling in the relations between Germany and Poland. This was especially visible during U.S. President Donald Trump's recent visit to Europe. He was given a very warm reception in Poland, but then a very frosty one in Germany. So there are some significant disagreements and differences between Berlin and Warsaw at present. But if you look beyond those headlines and deeper into the heart of Europe, we can see that Germany and Poland are actually moving closer in some very profound ways. To tell us about this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Around July 9th and July 11th, the very senior leaders in the German and the Polish military got together. The Inspector General of the German military, which is kind of a title that sounds, I don't know, almost like a janitor, but it's actually pretty much the most senior figure in the military. He was meeting with a Polish brigadier general, and they were talking about military cooperation between these two countries. And it is a significant, it gives us some very significant information when it comes to that German-Polish relationship. Because as you said in that intro, there are some real genuine disagreements between the two. And when in October 2015, the latest Polish government, that traditionally is quite anti-German, was elected, there was a pause put on German military cooperation. But what this meeting just over a week ago really underscores is that that pause is over. And if anything, military relations between these two are accelerating. Actually, that pause ended about a year even before this meeting took place. But that meeting it underscores that even though you've got these disagreements and this party that isn't so enthusiastically pro-German as the previous one, they're still working together. So the program that was paused was a program where a German battalion would serve under a Polish brigade and a Polish battalion would serve under a German brigade. Hmm. A battalion, it's usually several hundred strong. So it's quite a big deal, and it would just pave the way, the hope is, for future cooperation and make it easier for these two armies to work together. And these two brigade, or this cooperation, it's a very natural fit, because especially the Polish army, a lot of its equipment, at least its newest equipment that it uses, is German. It's bought a whole load of used Leopard 2 tanks in the past from Germany. It's currently placed some significant contracts to have Germany upgrade those. And so at the meeting, they talked about this. They talked about the kind of the progress that they'd made so far. And now that they plan over the next year or two to really kind of finish up that project, to get these two working together, and to have basically part of the Polish army serving in the German army and vice versa.
This theme of Germany sort of quietly asserting control of various other European nations' militaries is one that you've been following quite closely over the years. Could you maybe just give us a quick overview of what we've seen happen in recent years with the other European nations involved in this trend?
Yeah, I think this is one of the biggest underreported news stories, I think, of recent years. At the moment, you've got now the majority of the Dutch army is in the German army. Hmm. They're under the German command structure now, which, that's huge. They've taken over the majority of the Dutch land forces. I think they have kind of now the special forces and some support divisions. But apart from that, the bulk of their, the heavy lifting capacity is under the German army. Then you've got the Romanian and the Czech armed forces. They're both integrating a brigade, a much larger unit of their army. Again, and again, in these cases, it's not the majority, but it's a significant chunk. I can't remember the stats off the top of my head, but we're talking somewhere in an order of magnitude of, say, 10, 20% of their army, that kind of a figure. So significant parts of their army moving in to the under German command. And in these two examples, the Polish relationship, it's reciprocal. You've got the same kind of size of German forces also serving in the Polish army. In these other cases, it's not. They're just going over into the German army. And Germany has said they've been quite open about what they're aiming to do here. They've talked about forming a multinational panzer division. And so that's an entire division, a huge component of an army made up of bits from other countries. And they've talked about openly that the plan here is to build a European army. And I think it was Thomas de Maizière, the previous but one, kind of, or the previous defense minister, who he articulated it very clearly. He basically said, look, we're getting nowhere with this big project of creating a European military. It keeps getting hung up. Britain keeps vetoing it, or some other nation. You know, there's all these disagreements. We're just going to get on with it. We'll pick one nation and we'll work with them, and then we'll bring two or three others on board, and then add a few more. And then by the time you've done that, we're halfway towards a European army already. So that's what they're aiming to do. And they've had huge success with that now, with three nations heavily on board, Poland now getting on board. Other nations like Austria have expressed some strong interest and have begun talks. I think it might have been Sweden, but some of the Nordic countries are kind of also pricking up their ears and paying attention. So they've gotten a good ways towards practically building a European military by this route.
Well, thanks very much for bringing us up to speed on that, Richard. Well, unless you've been hiding out in some remote Siberian village for the last 6 months or so, you will have heard a lot about Russia and America. Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. The mainstream media in the U.S. calls it one of the biggest scandals of the modern era. And often at the expense of worthwhile reporting, they have devoted an astounding amount of attention to this story, including to aspects of it that are apparently totally unsubstantiated. But trumpet writer Andrew Miller says that even though what the U.S. media is calling a scandal probably is not one, he says that there is an actual and real Russia scandal. What can you tell us about this, Andrew?
Right. Well, it's not something probably most our listeners have heard of, maybe a few, because it hasn't gotten a ton of press coverage. But back at the very end of last month, June 29th, there was a letter released by two Republican congressmen, Representative Lamar Smith and Representative Randy Weber, both working for the Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, warning that Russian companies have actually been funneling millions of dollars into the United States to fund environmental groups and anti-fracking groups. There's some reports released by the Heritage Center confirming this, showing that up to $55 million has come from a constellation of Russian groups that have made it to organizations like the Sierra Club or the Natural Resource Defense Council, that's been used for political activism against the shale oil industry.
So is this because Vladimir Putin is very concerned about America's environmental health and
yes.
wants us to
Vladimir
to
Putin,
go
he,
green?
He's a great, he's a very great environmentalist, and he loved the American people so much that he wants them to have even cleaner air and even cleaner water than they have in Russia. But no, this letter, it actually cites the previous Secretary General of NATO mentioning that this isn't a unique thing to America. Russia's been doing this in Eastern Europe for some time now, realizing that one of the biggest threats to Russia, I mean, their economy is mostly based off fossil fuel exports.
Right.
They have great dominance over Eastern Europe because of their fossil fuel exports. Mm-hmm. We covered on this program last week how President Trump is wanting to up fracking operations and offshore oil drilling operations and oil drilling operations on public land and coal mining operations as a way to actually position America as a net energy exporter. So we can start selling to Poland and some of these other nations and trying to break their dependence on Russia.
Right.
Obviously, Putin, that would be like the worst possible thing that could happen to him. And so, like he's done in some of these Eastern Europe, is if he can fund groups that agitate against fossil fuel extraction for environmental reasons, obviously not within his own country, but within other countries, and try to weaken their oil industry, that makes that those nations, which are still reliant on fossil fuels, have little option but to buy from him.
Well, this is really fascinating, Andrew. Is this at all connected to the allegations that Russia hacked America's, you know, the 2016 presidential election?
That is a good question. And most people, the FBI, the CIA, even President Trump himself, admit that Russia did hack the Democratic National Convention and expose several emails revealing some of the underhanded techniques Hillary Clinton used against Bernie Sanders in the election. Mm-hmm. Some people think some of the Bernie Sanders voters may have stayed home and sulked over that and tipped the election to Trump. Now, and so even though there is no evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russia campaign for doing this, you do still have to ask the question, what was Russia trying to gain by hacking the Democratic National Committee? Right. And I think Victor Davis Hanson had a pretty good piece on National Review this week, kind of just showing that this is another Russian strategy. In addition to funding anti-energy groups, they also try to use a strategy called disaggregation, where you look for existing political divides within nations that are rival to you, mm-hmm. and then do anything you can to like rub salt in the wound and exacerbate those divides to where if you can get them into inner civil strife, they're not focusing on you. And there's been a number of like Newsweek and other things that have really pointed out that the fact that to say that Russia was trying to install Donald Trump as president, or to say even more ridiculous to say that President Trump was colluding with Russia to steal an election, has really no basis in fact. But to say that Russia is using some of these hacking techniques to sow civil unrest in a nation, which has had happened. I mean, our government's pretty much been in gridlock for the past 6 months as they've argued over whether President Trump is a Russian stooge or not, which that really is probably the main reason Russia did this in the first place. Keep Americans fighting amongst themselves and then finance groups that oppose U.S. energy extraction as mm-hmm. part of like a hybrid war strategy to try to keep America from becoming a powerful enough energy exporter as to rival Russia in Eastern Europe.
Could you put this in the context of the end time Bible prophecies that we're watching for?
Right. And there are very few prophecies relating to relations between the kings of the East and America in specific. But there are many prophecies about civil war, civil unrest, rioting in the cities within America.
Yes.
And so if America is looking at becoming a net energy exporter and now Russia is trying to finance groups that are trying to stop that, or use hacking techniques to pit American against American, that could definitely play into those prophecies.
Well, that's very interesting, Andrew. We thank you for that story. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. And most of the stories that we are discussing today are on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they will be up there very soon if they're not yet. I would encourage you to go there and check them out just to get more information and also links to free books and booklets that relate to these stories that we're discussing. We're going to take a break in just a moment, but first we'll cover one more Russia story, and that is that President Vladimir Putin's crackdown on the Russian media is becoming more and more extreme and draconian. For this, we'll go to Kieran Underwood.
Yeah, well, I'll just start with the most fascinating sentence or the most dramatic sentence in this new Human Rights Watch report, which was called Online and On All Fronts, Russia's Assault on Freedom of Expression. Here's a sentence: state intrusion in media affairs has reached a level not seen in Russia since the fall of the Soviet Union. So you have, it's not at the height where you have Stalin going back and editing school textbooks with his own pencil and pen. It's not at that height, but it is the most since you had seen the fall of that Soviet Union in the 90s. So this Human Rights Watch report came out. It was this huge 20,000-word document, and it details all these ways that state media is intruding in people's ability to report on news events, to just tell their opinion on blogs, tell their opinion on social media, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of this is happening on the internet because Russia's internet usage has just dramatically risen. I mean, along with the rest of the world as well. Back in 2008, when he left the presidency, only 26% of Russia was online. When he came back in 2012 to the presidency, 60% were online, and now it's 70%. So now you have this different form where people can dissent. It's meant to be anonymous. It's instantaneous, and it's everywhere. So you have this different form of communication that needs to be cracked down on if you want to have a united Russia, as the party of Vladimir Putin's party is called. So they do this. They're cracking down through a number of ways. They're banning things which they term extremism, and the idea being that they get to determine exactly what extremism is. They ban things like separatism in the news. If you say something about Crimea, that Russia's occupying Crimea, that would be separatism, and that's banned. Or in other cases, they simply will just ban websites. Sometimes they'll give a reason for the ban, and then sometimes they don't give a reason. They just ban it anyway.
Can you give us some examples of specific media organs that have been silenced?
Yeah, well, there were so many when I was going through this report. It's 20,000 words, so it's so many. You can't cover all of them, but I'll just give a few here. The country's leading independent news agency, or was, is a website called lenta.ru, and it was accused of publishing an extremist article. Of course, they would deny that claim. Anyhow, the chief editor of that news agency was fired immediately, and then almost the entire staff resigned in protest. So that company was pretty much entirely lost just because of that one claim of extremism. Then back in 2013, you had Jehovah's Witnesses. And I think you've covered this in a number of articles. The Jehovah's Witnesses site was deemed extremist. That was banned as well. And then just recently, I think the Russian courts came back, and there was a number of appeals, and the Russian courts came back and said, yes, the Jehovah's Witnesses are extremists, their website's banned, et cetera, et cetera. There's some more examples. The Russian Ministry of Justice maintains this list of 4,000 items that are extremists, and it includes like audio and video and different things you can or cannot say. So it contains over 4,000 items, which means it's so long and it's so big and in some parts contradictory that you don't even know what's illegal, what's legal. There's a story in history, in Roman history, Caligula, the emperor, used to post new laws that he had created in places that were so high and in handwriting that was so small that no one could read what the new laws were saying. So this way he could keep everyone in fear. They didn't know what the laws were. I think this is kind of the same thing when you have a list of 4,000 items that are listed as extremist, then there's no real way you can keep track of it. And then they can add things at any time. So you have this arbitrary rulings of what's extremist, what's not, and who can be prosecuted, who could be sent to prison. All these different types of things.
So this is a really wide-ranging, almost all-encompassing clamp down there. Do you have any advice for journalists in Russia who might be listening in today?
Well, actually, part of the in part of the report, there was a news agency that started reporting on Putin's the number of luxury houses that he's built. He's built a number of them. I think one of them's near the Black Sea. But they started reporting on that, and then the state cracked down on them, got rid of some of their editors. And in order to get rid of the state intrusion, they just said, we continue to be independent, but we just stop reporting about Putin's luxury houses and spending government money. So their solution was, well, we're just not going to cover the sensitive topics anymore.
It's probably the way to survive right now. Well, thanks very much for that, Kieran. You're listening to Trumpet Hour here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial, and the live stream is available anywhere in the world if you just type kpcg.fm into your internet browser. Coming up, we're going to talk about how Europe's migrant crisis is back in the headlines, new figures that shed light on a Middle Eastern arms race, China's drive to become a tech leader, and how America's healthcare could bankrupt the nation. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Jeremiah Jacques filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. For the last several years, news about an ongoing crisis of migrants pouring into Europe from the Middle East and North Africa dominated a lot of the headlines about European news. But then for a time, the situation seemed to have been mitigated and maybe stabilized, and we didn't hear so much about it. But now that crisis is back. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so last week we talked about how migrants coming into Italy have been coming back in the news. And now just the situation in Germany is once again up for debate. It kind of seemed like things had been put to bed, that the German politics had moved on, that Angela Merkel had kind of said, well, yep, I learned my lesson. We're not going to handle things in exactly the same way in the future. And we'd kind of moved on. Now things are coming back to a head. And one of the big things that did this was a music festival last weekend in Schandorf in the state of Baden-Württemberg, where there was a large group of young people. The number varies wildly. Some reports say 1,000. Then there was another report that said actually it was only 100 troublemakers. Even so, 100 is a large number, where they were throwing bottles at the police. And what kind of really caught everybody's attention is that the police said that many of these young people came from a, quote, immigrant background. At the same music festival, there were reports of, again, sexual harassment from migrants in the way that we saw in the past in Germany, that have kind of stirred things up. And then politically, this started to become a big deal. And so Jens Spahn, he's a member of German Chancellor Angela Merkel's own party. He kind of gave an interview on Wednesday that drew a lot of publicity to this event and itself gained a lot of publicity, where he said that Schandorf is a symbol of what is happening on a daily basis in many places in Germany. He said that it's becoming more and more clear how big a task integration is. Spahn is a homosexual politician, and he said that this massive influx in Muslim migrants is making Germany homophobic and anti-Semitic. Or he said, we must face up to this. He said, too many people are of the opinion that every other culture is an enrichment. I do not feel that the everyday debasement that women experience is an enrichment. And so this event and then the subsequent media is making this an issue once again in Germany. Not as big of an issue, I don't think, as it was a few years ago, but it's still it's an issue again, and there's an election in September. So it's going to be something that's probably going to remain an issue over the summer.
Yeah, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has just come out and said that she does not want to set any upper limits on how many migrant refugees can come into Germany. What bearing do you think that statement and her approach to Muslim migrants in general could have on her hopes for re-election?
I know she tries to have her cake and eat it a bit in Germany on the migrants, or at least her opinion seems to change a lot now. Like, sometimes she tries to put forward this, okay, I've learned my lesson, we've changed, we're not going to have this same kind of policy again, and we have to accept unlimited migration as a mistake. She's kind of made statements to try and give that impression, and usually she'll say that when speaking to her own supporters. At the same time, she also wants to try and put forward this multicultural, friendly, opening, compassionate, you know, alternative leader of the free world to Donald Trump image.
Yes.
And so she'll kind of say the opposite. And you get this all. I'm sure she's very careful so that she doesn't contradict herself in terms of the letter of what she says. But it leads to almost the schizophrenic policy where they try and find some things that they can do, and they've made some dramatic changes in terms of deporting migrants who don't have a right to stay, deporting migrants to countries in North Africa that were previously deemed too dangerous to deport them to. So she's trying to be all people to all men. And exactly how far she succeeds with that in September remains to be seen. It wouldn't surprise me if she got elected that time, but trying to be all people to all men, it's always something that comes back to bite you in the long run. And maybe she'll pull it off for a few months, but I think in the long run, that's going to lead to just the same kind of suspicion that we see of politicians, of mainstream politicians everywhere, the same kind of dissatisfaction that led to the election of Donald Trump in America, where people just kind of get to this point where they say, well, politicians lie all the time. They don't mean what they say. We can't be trusted. We've got to kind of reach outside of what's considered normal politicians now to find someone that we can actually trust.
Could you talk briefly about which specific countries most of these migrants are coming from and why they're fleeing those nations?
Well, in terms of what's in the headline and what's causing trouble right now are the migrants that came in before on the previous wave of migration. A lot of those were Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and they're trying to send back a lot of the ones from, say, Afghanistan. I think they've declared that that country is safe, even though they still have a major military mission there. The more recent ones tend to be coming from North Africa, from Nigeria. There's quite a few coming up there, Libya, Algeria, and these are the ones they're much more keen on trying to send back. These migrants are causing much more of a problem in Italy, and Austria is kind of screening some of those so that a lot of those aren't making it up to Germany in the same way that earlier wave of migrants from the Middle East did.
Thank you very much for that, Richard. Well, in the first half, we talked about the ongoing crisis at the Temple Mount there in Jerusalem, Israel, and the way this could lead to turmoil that could affect the whole region. And there was another news story this week showing that a massive arms race is underway in the Middle East, which could make any such turmoil in that region that much more destructive. To tell us about this arms race, we'll go once again to Brent.
Yeah, there was a new report that came out by IHS this week, and it discusses global defense exports and imports, and it looks at the regions of the world. And many regions of the world have shown a decrease in military spending or arms imports, at least. They might be growing their own domestic weapons production, so it doesn't account for that. But the one startling thing in this report is how much the Middle East is heading towards, or is already in, an arms race. And the nations that are consuming or are purchasing a lot of arms are basically nations that are in the anti-Iranian camp. So if we would, the big one, of course, being Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the global top importer of arms. It imports nearly three times as much as its closest rival, India. And it looks like over the next 3 or 4 years, that will continue to be exactly the same way, because they've got a lot of current orders in where there will be deliveries and payments for naval vehicles, aircraft and such. So we have Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Algeria, Iraq. Iraq's, it's no surprise there, mm-hmm. as well. But here's a region that is talked about as being the most volatile area in the world, and just adding more and more and more arms to it really will exacerbate, or really does pose an even greater threat to exacerbate that that volatility, to the point that when it is set off, when that match is set off, we will have a far greater conflagration.
So does this look like it's primarily an arms race then just between the Sunni powers and Iran?
Well, Iran doesn't get weaponry from many other nations. It gets a little bit from Russia. That's probably overreported how much it gets from Russia, I believe. But its own domestic supply and domestic production has increased. They construct their own ballistic missiles. They're firing those all every now and then. They're to test those. They're also they've got their own naval ships that they're constructing as well. This report looked at the imports, and that is, again, from the anti-Iranian camp. But it is in response to Iran's growth militarily, to the amount of cash Iran now has to, because of the nuclear deal, to put towards their own domestic production, as well as their own exporting of terrorism and violence across the Middle East. That's the big takeaway from this. Would we have seen Saudi Arabia increase its defense spending to the degree that it has, if not for Iran's growth in its own domestic production? I don't think so. So really, it's Iran's rise in the Middle East that is fueling Saudi Arabia, UAE, and these other Sunni states' rise in defense spending.
So Saudi Arabia and these other Sunni states see Iran rising. They see it becoming more threatening to the region, and they're just basically taking precautions to be able to counter the threat posed by the regime there. Well, we sure appreciate that, Brent. All of the stories that we are discussing today, or almost all of them anyway, are published on thetrumpet.com. Please visit there to check these stories out and also to subscribe to our free print edition and our free email news briefs. Well, for the last few decades, the Made in China stamp that we see on so many products sold around the world has not inspired a lot of faith in quality or technological sophistication. But in recent years, the Chinese have been investing in all kinds of initiatives to change that and to become a tech leader, especially in the realm of artificial intelligence. To bring us up to speed on this trend, we'll go once again to Kieran.
Thank you. Yeah, China is planning on getting very big on artificial intelligence. Just yesterday, July 20, China released this plan where they outlined that they were going to become the leader in AI. They said that that AI is so important now that it's reached the level of national strategy. And their president, Chinese President Xi Jinping, actually talked about this before this report was released. On May 14, when he had his One Belt, One Road summit, which is his big plan to reinvent the Silk Road, the ancient Silk Road, he mentioned that China had this ambition on innovation, including digital economy, nanotechnology, quantum computers, and AI. So he's going for a big broad stroke there. But this newly published plan has three different stages. I'll just go through the three stages quickly. By 2020, they aim to be in the world's advanced level, and they want to have about $22.5 billion worth of investment. By 2025, 5 years later, they want to be at the leading level. So they want to be leading by 2025, and then by 2030, they say they want China to be the world center of AI technology and the AI economy. And at the same time, if you look at the recent budget, which America just put out, President Trump has said he wants to cut spending on science research. He has to find places to cut because his military spending was 10% larger than the last year. So he's cutting science. At the same time, China is investing. It plans at the end to invest about $150 billion over those 12 coming years. And this is kind of a trend that you see with supercomputers as well. Just last month, there was a report that came out looking at the top 500 supercomputers. China had the top two supercomputers there as well. So you kind of see this trend everywhere in supercomputers and technology. China may not be the best yet, and China definitely doesn't have the leading technology in AI at the moment, but they do plan on becoming that leader in the world.
So they have some lofty ambitions, but still quite a ways to go. Is there still anything that you identify as a trigger that really prompted China's push into artificial intelligence?
Yeah, well, the two professors who consulted the government when they were writing this report said that in 2016, there was a big event. What happened was this Asian game called Go. It's a bit make an equivalent to the Western game of chess. They had a computer, or a Google computer, called AlphaGo, which played the South Korean master. And it defeated the South Korean master. Then Google came to China. It played their top Go player, and it defeated their top Go player as well. So it's a bit like your Deep Blue Kasparov chess match, where the world suddenly realized that AI computers could be, you know, as intelligent as human beings in some of these games. And politicians really latched onto that in China, because they saw the potential. They beat the Chinese master in Go, so they realized that they had to do something about it. Some people are calling it a Sputnik moment for China, where they now have to put in a lot of funds to try and increase their ability to develop AI. Another part of this is that they want to use this as a boost for their economy. A lot of people have been talking lately about the Chinese economy and the slowdown that's been happening. Actually, the last quarter, they had 6.9% growth, I think, in GDP. So there's mixed reports about that, but they want AI to be this big part of their economy that can boost their GDP.
Well, thanks very much for that, Kieran. On Monday of this week, two more Republican senators here in the U.S. announced that they oppose the second version of their own party's plan to repeal and replace Obamacare. So this announcement effectively doomed the legislation and the Trump administration's efforts to come up with a viable solution for Obamacare. So for the time being, Obamacare will remain in place, and America's healthcare spending will continue to soar to just unfathomable levels. Some analysts are saying that healthcare spending is now so out of control that it is set to bankrupt America. To tell us about this sobering possibility, we'll go once again to Andrew Miller.
Right. Well, with this new, some of the new developments this week, it does look like it is at least going to be some time before anyone gets around to repealing Obamacare. But there are definitely, when you crunch the math, you know that this is something that is almost of like economic survival to the nation. Just a few numbers, you know that in the past 8 years, the national debt level has doubled from $10 trillion to $20 trillion. And according to the Congressional Budget Office, it's projected to balloon out to an astounding $92 trillion in the next 30 years.
Wow.
So depending on what the interest level is at that point, that could mean that within three decades, you could see 100% of American tax revenues going to paying the interest on the debt.
That's astounding.
And so your owner is like, what are we spending this money on? And they actually said that, well, at least as a share of GDP, the only two sectors of the budget that are increasing are Social Security and health care. Currently, we spend about 5% of our gross domestic product on government health care. Hmm. Although within the next 30 years, it's projected to balloon out to almost 9%. So massive increases. And then when you crunch that, I mean, people say, well, how are you going to pay for it? And most liberals will say, well, okay, we'll increase taxes. Like, okay, that is something you could do, but when you crunch the numbers, you're going to have to increase them by a per capita amount of $10,000 per family above what you're paying now.
Wow.
To pay for this type of healthcare, these projected increases. You could say tax the rich, but even if you taxed everyone, I mean, the rich are a small percentage of the nation, so even if you were taxed everyone who makes more than $1 million at an exorbitant rate, you'd only pay for maybe 1% on a program that's 1% of GDP. You increase tax revenues 1% of GDP on a healthcare program that's projected to increase spending by 5% of GDP. Or you could also say cut the military, but actually, like I said, as a percentage of GDP, military spending is already going down. And we currently spend about 5% of our GDP on defense. And that's projected down to be under 3% in the next 30 years. And so when you really look at the math, I mean, the only solution you have to stopping a circumstance where you're spending 100% of tax revenues on debt interest is you either need to repeal or drastically reform government health care.
So what would be a viable replacement to the current model?
From an economic standpoint, the best replacement would be to repeal Obamacare and replace it with nothing. Just go back to the system that worked for America for the first two centuries of its existence, where you just buy whatever healthcare program you want. I mean, there is people say it's like, oh, we need free healthcare, but it's there's no such thing as free anything. Someone's paying for it. And actually, you say, it's like, well, okay, well, now the rich should pay for the poor. And that's even the rich don't even have enough money to pay for the poor. So when they say free healthcare, basically, I mean, it's being financed by debt and it's not free. You're robbing the money from your grandchildren.
So it sounds like there are really no simple solutions to this at all. That's a really sobering report there, Andrew. We appreciate you bringing that to our attention. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Please visit us there to read more about the stories that we're discussing today and to subscribe to our print edition and our news brief, which we send out several times each week. We'll finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour.
It's time now for our lightning round. One last brief look at some of the other big headlines from this week that caught our attention. First, we'll go to Richard.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, the term ladies and gentlemen is now banned on the London Underground. Apparently, it is too offensive to those who don't believe that they are either ladies or gentlemen or think they are both. It was banned just over the last weekend, and it comes after a whole slew of similar news from the UK. For example, the Church of England's governing body voted to have a special service for transgendered individuals, and supporters of it talked about how they thought the church should have a kind of a special welcome to people to mark their transition. Also this week, the Church of England announced that they would soon be holding their first homosexual marriage. And there was a poll published over the last week or so that found that nearly half of people interviewed believed that it was extremism to define marriage as a union between a man and a woman only.
Okay, and now to Brent.
The four Arab states blockading Qatar have moderated their demands. They previously presented to the Gulf Kingdom, Saudi Arabia, and its allies have reduced the list from 13 specific requirements to 6 broad principles, while backing away from some of their more contentious demands, such as the dismantling of Al Jazeera. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, he's traveling to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Kuwait on Sunday and Monday in an attempt to finally mediate the crisis to resolution.
And now to Andrew.
U.S. officials announced this morning that the Trump administration is planning to ban American citizens from traveling to North Korea. This announcement comes following the death of university student Otto Warmbler, who died in June after falling into a coma in a North Korean prison. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has announced that the ban will go into place 30 days after a notice is officially published in the Federal Register.
Okay, and Kieran.
Pew Global conducted a poll on who is considered the world's leading economic power. And across 38 nations that Pew polled, a median of 42% said the U.S. was the world's leading economy, while 32% named China. But in 7 of the 10 European Union nations in the study, China was considered the leading economic power.
Okay, now back to Richard.
Britain's GCHQ this week, that's the Communications Intelligence Agency, announced that Britain's energy companies were hacked on the day of the general election. Back in June, they said that they were hacked by state-sponsored hostile actors, which is a euphemism for Russia. And this comes after Ireland's energy was hacked by groups backed by Moscow's GRU intelligence agency. It comes after America's energy infrastructure, including its nuclear power plants, were hit at the same time. The British officials were quoted in the newspaper saying that they were that passwords were taken and that they were concerned that this was designed to basically lay the groundwork for an attack in the future that could bring the country to its knees. And the Telegraph quoted an anonymous senior intelligence source saying that the reality is the Russians have been hacking everything they can get their hands on.
Okay, and now back over to Brent.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu meeting with Eastern European leaders in Budapest was caught on an open microphone as he encouraged the EU to build closer ties with Israel. Here are a couple of quotes from his while the mic was on. He said, quote, "I think Europe has to decide if it wants to live and thrive or if it wants to shrivel and disappear. I'm not politically correct. I know that's a shock to some of you, but the truth is both about Europe's security and Europe's economic future. Both of these concerns mandate a different policy towards Israel." And then he said, "Don't undermine the one European Western country that defends European values and European interests and prevents another mass migration to Europe. Stop attacking Israel. Start supporting Israel."
And Andrew?
In the first ever global analysis of plastic productions, researchers have discovered that mankind has manufactured 9.1 billion tons of plastic since polypropylene was first discovered in 1954. While roughly a third of this plastic is still in use, an astounding 5.4 billion tons has already been thrown away. That's enough to bury Manhattan Island under more than 2 miles of trash. Since plastics don't break down like other man-made materials, 3/4 of the stuff usually ends up in landfills, oceans, rivers, and lakes.
And now back to Kieran.
According to a Russian poll, more than half of Russians, 62%, agree that commemorative plaques, busts, and pictures featuring Stalin's achievements should be installed in public places. And young people are the ones who tend to like these memorials. The senior citizens, on the other hand, do not, probably because they're a little bit older and they're able to remember a little more about Stalin.
And for our last story, we'll go once again to Richard.
Yesterday was the deadliest one-day period of all of 2017 in Ukraine. 9 Ukrainian soldiers died in the regions of Donetsk and Mariupol. It comes after a separatist leader declared plans to found a new country called Malorossiya, and has led to worries that we could be on the brink of another outbreak of violence or Russian push in that region of Ukraine.
Well, thank you for that, Richard. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our print edition and also to our Trumpet Brief. Tell us what you think about the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, Kieran Underwood, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Steve Herkus. And we'll leave you today with the words of Henry David Thoreau. "There are 1,000 hacking at the branches of evil to everyone who is striking at the root." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.